It is solemnity that is stopping the way in every department of modern effort. It is his own favorite serious methods. It is his own favorite momentousness. It is his own favorite judgment which stops the way everywhere. Every man who has ever headed a deputation to a minister knows this. Every man who has ever written a letter to the Times knows it. Every rich man who wishes to stop the mouths of the poor talks about momentousness. Every cabinet minister who has not got an answer suddenly develops a judgment. Every sweater who uses vile methods recommends serious methods. I said a moment ago that sincerity had nothing to do with solemnity, but I confess that I am not so certain that I was right. In the modern world, at any rate, I am not so sure that I was right. In the modern world, solemnity is the direct enemy of sincerity. In the modern world, sincerity is almost always on one side and solemnity almost always on the other. The only answer possible to the fierce and glad attack of sincerity is the miserable answer of solemnity. Let Mr. McCabe, or anyone else who is much concerned that we should be grave in order to be sincere, simply imagine the scene in some government office in which Mr. Bernard Shaw should head a socialist deputation to Mr. Austin Chamberlain. On which side would be solemnity, and on which the sincerity? I am indeed delighted to discover that Mr. McCabe reckons Mr. Shaw along with me in his system of condemnation of frivolity. He said once, I believe, that he always wanted Mr. Shaw to label his paragraphs serious or comic. I do not know which paragraphs of Mr. Shaw are paragraphs to be labeled serious, but surely there can be no doubt that this paragraph of Mr. McCabe's is one to be labeled comic. He also says in the article I am now discussing that Mr. Shaw has the reputation of deliberately saying everything which his hearers do not expect him to say. I need not labor the inconclusiveness and weakness of this, because it has already been dealt with in my remarks on Mr. Bernard Shaw. Suffice it to say here that the only serious reason which I can imagine inducing any one person to listen to any other is that the first person looks to the second person with an ardent faith and a fixed attention, expecting him to say what he does not expect him to say. It may be a paradox, but that is because paradoxes are true. It may not be rational, but that is because rationalism is wrong. But clearly it is quite true that whenever we go to hear a prophet or teacher, we may or may not expect wit, we may or may not expect eloquence, but we do expect what we do not expect. We may not expect the true, but we may not even expect the wise, but we do expect the unexpected. If we do not expect the unexpected, why do we go there at all? If we expect the expected, why do we not sit at home and expect it by ourselves? If Mr. McCabe means merely this about Mr. Shaw, that he always has some unexpected application of his doctrine to give to those who listen to him, what he says is quite true, and to say it is only to say that Mr. Shaw is an original man. But if he means that Mr. Shaw has ever professed or preached any doctrine but one, and that his own, then what he says is not true. It is not my business to defend Mr. Shaw. As has been seen already, I disagree with him altogether. But I do not mind on his behalf offering in this matter a flat defiance to all his ordinary opponents, such as Mr. McCabe. I defy Mr. McCabe, or anybody else, to mention one single instance in which Mr. Shaw has, for the sake of wit or novelty, taken up any position which was not directly deductible from the body of his doctrine as elsewhere expressed. I have been, I am happy to say, a tolerably close student of Mr. Shaw's utterances, and I request Mr. McCabe, if he will not believe that I mean anything else, to believe that I mean this challenge. All this, however, is a parenthesis. The thing with which I am here immediately concerned is Mr. McCabe's appeal to me not to be so frivolous. Let me return to the actual text of that appeal. There are, of course, a great many things that I might say about it in detail, but I may start with saying that Mr. McCabe is in error in supposing that the danger which I anticipate from the disappearance of religion is the increase of sensuality. On the contrary, I should be inclined to anticipate a decrease in sensuality, because I anticipate a decrease in life. I do not think that under modern Western materialism we should have anarchy. I doubt whether we should have enough individual valor and spirit even to have liberty. It is quite an old-fashioned fallacy to suppose that our objection to skepticism is that it removes the discipline from life. Our objection to skepticism is that it removes the motive power. Materialism is not a thing which destroys mere restraint. Materialism itself is the great restraint. The McCabe school advocates a political libertary, but it denies spiritual liberty. That is, it abolishes the laws which could be broken and substitutes laws that cannot, and that is the real slavery. The truth is that the scientific civilization in which Mr. McCabe believes has one rather particular defect. It is perpetually tending to destroy that democracy or power of the ordinary man in which Mr. McCabe also believes. Science means specialism, and specialism means oligarchy. If you once establish the habit of trusting particular men to produce particular results in physics or astronomy, you leave the door open for the equally natural demand that you should trust particular men to do particular things in government and the coercing of men. If you feel it to be reasonable that one beetle should be the only study of one man, and that one man the only student of that one beetle, it is surely a very harmless consequence to go on to say that politics should be the only study of one man, and that one man the only student of politics. As I have pointed out elsewhere in this book, the expert is more aristocratic than the aristocrat, because the aristocrat is only the man who lives well, while the expert is the man who knows better. But if we look at the progress of our scientific civilization, we see a gradual increase everywhere of the specialist over the popular function. Once men sang together round a table in chorus, and now one man sings alone, for the absurd reason that he can sing better. If scientific civilization goes on, which is most improbable, only one man will laugh, because he can laugh better than the rest. I do not know that I can express this more shortly than by taking as a text the single sentence of Mr. McCabe, which runs as follows, quote, "The ballets of the Alhambra and the fireworks of the Crystal Palace and Mr. Chesterton's daily news articles have their places in life." End of quote. I wish that my articles had as noble a place as either of the other two things mentioned. But let us ask ourselves, in a spirit of love, as Mr. Chadbond would say, what are the ballets of the Alhambra? The ballets of the Alhambra are institutions in which a particular selected row of persons in pink go through an operation known as dancing. Now, in all commonwealths dominated by a religion, in the Christian commonwealths of the Middle Ages and in many rude societies, this habit of dancing was a common habit with everybody, and was not necessarily confined to a professional class. A person could dance without being a dancer. A person could dance without being a specialist. A person could dance without being pink. And in proportion as Mr. McCabe's scientific civilization advances, that is, in proportion as religious civilization, or real civilization, decays, the more and more well-trained, the more and more pink become the people who do dance, and the more and more numerous become the people who don't. Mr. McCabe may recognize an example of what I mean in the gradual discrediting in society of the ancient European waltz or dance with partners, and the substitution of that horrible and degrading Oriental interlude which is known as skirt dancing. That is the whole essence of decadence, the effacement of five people who do a thing for fun by one person who does it for money. Now it follows, therefore, that when Mr. McCabe says that the ballets of the Alhambra and my articles have their place in life, it ought to be pointed out to him that he is doing his best to create a world in which dancing, properly speaking, will have no place in life at all. He is indeed trying to create a world in which there will be no life for dancing to have a place in. The very fact that Mr. McCabe thinks of dancing as a thing belonging to some hired women at the Alhambra is an illustration of the same principle by which he is able to think of religion as a thing belonging to some hired men in white neckties. Both these things are things which should not be done for us, but by us. If Mr. McCabe were really religious, he would be happy. If he were really happy, he would dance. Briefly, we may put the matter in this way. the main point of modern life is not that the Alhambra ballet has its place in life. The main point, the main enormous tragedy of modern life, is that Mr. McCabe has not his place in the Alhambra ballet. The joy of changing and graceful posture, the joy of suiting the swing of music to the swing of limbs, the joy of whirling drapery, the joy of standing on one leg, all these should belong by rights to Mr. McCabe and to me. In short, to the ordinary healthy citizen. Probably we should not consent to go through these evolutions, but that is because we are miserable moderns and rationalists. We do not merely love ourselves more than we love duty. We actually love ourselves more than we love joy. When, therefore, Mr. McCabe says that he gives the Alhambra dances and my articles their place in life, I think we are justified in pointing out that by the very nature of the case of his philosophy and of his favorite civilization, he gives them a very inadequate place. For, if I may pursue the too flattering parallel, Mr. McCabe thinks of the Alhambra and of my articles as two very odd and absurd things, which some special people do, probably for money, in order to amuse him. But if he had ever felt himself the ancient, sublime, elemental human instinct to dance, he would have discovered that dancing is not a frivolous thing at all, but a very serious thing. He would have discovered that it is the one grave and chaste and decent method of expressing a certain class of emotions. And similarly, if he had ever had, as Mr. Shaw and I have had, the impulse to what he calls paradox, he would have discovered that paradox, again, is not a frivolous thing, but a very serious thing. He would have found that paradox simply means a certain defiant joy which belongs to belief. I would regard any civilization which was without a universal habit of uproarious dancing as being, from the full human point of view, a defective civilization. And I should regard any mind which had not got the habit in one form or another of uproarious thinking as being, from the full human point of view, a defective mind. It is vain for Mr. McCabe to say that a ballet is a part of him. He should be a part of a ballet, or else he is only part of a man. It is in vain for him to say that he is not quarreling with the importance of humor into the controversy. He ought himself to be importing humor into every controversy, for unless a man is in part a humorist, he is only in part a man. To sum up the whole matter very simply, if Mr. McCabe asked me why I import frivolity into a discussion of the nature of man, I answer because frivolity is a part of the nature of man. If he asked me why I introduce what he calls paradoxes into a philosophical problem, I answer because all philosophical problems tend to become paradoxical. If he objects to my treating of life riotously, I reply that life is a riot. And I say that the universe, as I see it at any rate, is very much more like the fireworks at the Crystal Palace than it is like his own philosophy. About the whole cosmos there is a tense and secret festivity, like preparation for Guy Fawkes Day. Eternity is the eve of something. I never look up the stars without feeling that they are the fires of a schoolboy's rocket, fixed in their everlasting fall.